This edition of Monocle on Saturday was first broadcast on the 27th of April 2024. I'm Georgina Godwin, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. This is Monocle on Saturday. Now, coming up on today's programme, we'll have a look through the week's news and culture with writer and broadcaster Yasmin Abdel-Majid. Novelist and playwright Guy Gunnar Ratney joins us to talk about The Review, a new journal that celebrates writers of colour. And we look back at April's arts and culture moments with communications specialist and documentary filmmaker Isabella Orlando. First, though, here's the news. Aid shipments to Gaza from Cyprus resumed late on Friday, with a ship carrying food to the besieged Palestinian enclave after a pause following Israel's killing of seven aid workers. The World Central Kitchen NGO paused aid to review its activity in the territory after the early April attack. Meanwhile, the US has started construction of a floating jetty on Gaza's Mediterranean coast to enable aid delivery. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said today that violence against women is an epidemic in the country, as thousands attended rallies in Sydney and other major Australian cities, urging tougher laws on gendered violence. The demonstrations were spurred by a wave of violence against women that the government says has seen a woman killed every 4 days this year. The rallies also followed a mass stabbing in Sydney this month that killed 6 people, including 5 women. And Taiwan reported renewed Chinese military activity near the island today, with 12 aircraft crossing the sensitive median line of the Taiwan Strait, a day after US Secretary of State Antony Blinken ended a visit to China. The United States is Taiwan's most important international supporter and arms supplier, despite the absence of formal diplomatic ties. Blinken said he had stressed the critical importance of maintaining peace and stability across the strait whilst in China. And that's your Monocle Radio News. Hello and welcome to Monocle on Saturday. I'm Georgina Godwin. I'm joined in the studio by the writer and broadcaster Yasmin Abdel-Majid. Good morning to you, Yasmin.
Good morning. Now,
Guy Gunnar Ratney is only supposed to speak to us later, but he's here now.
Hello, folks.
Have you had enough coffee to talk to us yet?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. I'm just there about, yeah.
Yasmin, of course, you are from Australia, and that very disturbing story about violence in Australia. Is that something that you're aware of when you're there?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. There's sort of, it's the kind of conversation that has been around my whole life. Like, I remember these sorts of conversations happening in the 90s when I was growing up. So it's interesting to see. Well, the question really is whether or not this will be an actual sea change or whether this is just another sort of wave of frustration and pushback against the kind of violence. But, I mean, the knife crime that we've seen in Sydney more recently, that is new. That is something that we haven't really, the spate of stabbings. But violence against women generally has been something that I think Australia is well known for. Although what I would say is that there are quite good organisations in Australia, including one called Our Watch that I was involved in it when I lived in Australia, that is really focusing on like how to tackle the root underneath violence against women specifically. And that really, all the research shows, yes, alcohol is a compounding factor and this and this and this and socioeconomic status might be and so on. But really, at the end of the day, it's about gender inequality and misogyny and tackling that root cause.
Mm, and Guy, I know that that's something that you're very interested in, gender equality.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's interesting. I wasn't aware of this at all in Australia. And I know, you know, I can only go by my own impressions growing up in London, but also spending time in a smaller city across the way in Sweden, in Malmö, which has this reputation of gang violence, particularly stabbings, and it does feel apparent just as a resident there. Recently, there was a sporadic attack at a school just by where my children could go to kindergarten. And it's always top of mind when people move around and you know, raise their children. It's something that's it's concerning.
Absolutely. Now, of course, these are attacks in cities, in places where most of us, many of us, are lucky enough to go home to comfortable beds and all the rest of it. In conflict zones, of course, this kind of thing is going on all the time, but because it's just so awful all everywhere, it's not particularly remarked on. Now, I said you're Australian, but you're also Sudanese. I think it's worth having a look at what the UN is saying about an imminent attack in North Darfur.
Yeah, so this is quite a serious story, actually, and it's quite a terrifying one because I think it's kind of slipped under the radar. So the city of Al-Fashir, which is the last capital in Darfur state to not be under the militia's control, is currently at risk of, you know, a serious and imminent attack. And we're talking at least 800,000 people in a situation where they have nowhere to go. And the reason why Al-Fashir is such an... It's one of the biggest cities in the region, but also it's a city that has been under a truce for the majority of this past year's war. Early on in the conflict, which began in April last year, the local leaders set up a truce so that the militia and the army wouldn't fight in the area. And so people flooded from around Darfur, where there were all sorts of attacks, to this one safe place. And so you've got literally 500,000 refugees and internally displaced people from around the region, plus the citizens of that city to begin with. So the total number is over 1 million. They are now being surrounded by the militia. And the experts are essentially saying that this is the RSF, the militia, trying to complete the genocide that they began 20 years ago. Okay, they've described it as a kill box. The expert that I was listening to from the Yale Humanitarian Lab, who have kind of been looking at satellite imagery and so on, has said, you know, this is Nagasaki, Hiroshima and Nagasaki levels of catastrophe. That's what we're looking at. And his perspective, the executive director of the lab, Nathaniel Raymond, his perspective was like, we are at the point where we're looking at, we're turning from prevention to figuring out how we're going to deal with the aftermath. Now, there is a very small window, and, you know, this is, every time I'm on one call, I try to talk about Sudan, but this is maybe the most urgent time because there is this very small window of opportunity to try to stop the militia. Like, there are currently, you know, videos online of, like, tens, hundreds of utes full of militia, you know, armed to the teeth, heading towards Al-Fashir. And I think, you know, the international community's attention is so spread, you know, in there's Ukraine, there's Gaza, and all of these things very important. But the scale of this potential atrocity, the scale of this massacre is something that I think we don't even have, like, we cannot even comprehend. And so this is what the UN is warning against. I am glad to see, you know, I was looking this morning, there are more sort of pieces in the press about this. This warning came out at the beginning of the week. And people were saying, you know, this is a case of it will happen in days, not weeks or months. And I'm hoping that there is some sort of, because of, you know, the activists and experts trying to sort of put pressure on. I mean, really what needs to happen is an emergency meeting of the Security Council. You know, the UAE, who is well known to be a supporter of the militia, needs to sort of close the faucet of weaponry and financial support. And there needs to be a sense that this cannot happen because, you know, all the support for Darfuris that we saw 20 years ago, that's not existent at the moment. But we have to remember this was always the plan. The plan was always to essentially wipe out the African, the Masali, the Zaghawar tribes of Darfur. So this is something that is really, really urgent.
Where are the people in Al-Fashir going to?
Well, there's nowhere for them to go. That's the problem. There's nowhere for people in Al-Fashir to go because they are surrounded and also because the rest of the region has already been placed under the militia's control. So this was kind of the last safe haven.
Yeah. And I mean, even if they had somewhere to go, presumably the people don't have documents. It would be very, very difficult.
Very, very, very difficult.
Another country, of course, suffering with lack of documents is Ukraine. But that's only for young men who are trying to get their documents abroad. It's cut off consular services for male citizens who live outside the country, presumably to make them go back and join the military.
Exactly. This piece was really interesting. essentially talking about how Ukraine has decided for the male citizens who live outside the country, they will no longer have access to like passport renewals and similar things. In the only way they could do such thing is to go back to Ukraine. And the you know, quotes from Ukrainian foreign ministers and so on, essentially saying male citizens of military age who currently live outside Ukraine should it living abroad does not relieve a citizen of his or her duties to their homeland, they wrote. And you know, and so this is really, it's not even like a soft push. It's essentially demanding that you come back. At some point, people are going to have to, you know, access consular services. And so at some point, the push is to get them to, quote unquote, defend their country. And I mean, I think this is being met with varying levels of reactions around the world. I mean, some of the quotes in this particular article, are sort of people are glad that they were able to renew their passport on time before this measure came into place. But also, it might not actually be a legal measure. And so there are rumblings of legal action that will be taken against this kind of this legislation, or at least this policy, because it is unclear how, you know, like, is this actually allowed? I think that's up for grabs still.
Yeah, absolutely. A guy living abroad half the time, I'm never quite sure which country you're in. Yeah. But is that whole sort of the issue of coming, passports and embassies and visas and all the rest of it, an issue for you?
Yeah, well, my family and I decided to move to Malmö around 2017, which, as you can imagine, was a time where we didn't know where anything stood in terms of visas or anything like that post-Brexit. It's just sort of calcified into this kind of strange jockeying at every customs border. It's trying to figure out, okay, I have children, and if my mixed-race daughter is with me and my wife is not, there's always questions about, where is your wife?
Exactly. Oh,
that's not something I've ever encountered until the last couple of years. Mm. It's always there, and it annoys me every single time. I have a sort of Article 15 legislated little document that I have to give past every EU border. It's not just Sweden. It's difficult and it's annoying. I'm also just trying to figure out how to get a dual citizenship for my children. That's also it's long.
Just something really interesting on that as well. Like, a lot of Muslim women don't take their husbands' last names. And something that comes up at borders a lot is, like, if you're, like, my mother, for example, her last name is not the same as mine. And so people would always question, like, how are you related? And can you prove that you are these children's mother?
Yeah,
because
right.
The last name is different. You might be a different shade, whatever. The sort of discrimination at the border takes lots of different forms, as I'm sure.
I've had that with names,
really?
Too. My name's different from my daughter, and there's an issue. Although I have to say, once she went to Canada with her father, and the Canadian border people phoned me in England going, so you know this child is here, which I thought was really, really good, actually.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
From the other side. Guy, you're actually, do you have a Sri Lankan passport? Because that's your ethnic background.
Yeah, yes. No, I don't. I've always had a British passport.
And did you have a big wedding? This is going somewhere, by the way.
Do you know what? We decided on a very, very, very small wedding. My partner's from Finland, so we had a very small wedding in Finland. And of course, my mother then intervened and said, well, you're going to have what's called a homecoming in Sri Lanka. So we had a massive thing. There was a little baby elephant and everything.
Oh, wow.
At the Mount Lavinia Hotel.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah,
that's epic.
It was great. Yeah. It was great. All my Western friends were very impressed by this little
elephant. Do you have pictures of the baby elephant?
Yeah, I'll show you after.
Guys, like, this happens every time.
Okay, so the reason that we're going here is for a story that Yasmin has spotted, which is UK South Asian garment stores are suffering because people are having smaller weddings. Clearly doesn't apply to you.
Well, yeah, I thought this story was very interesting because, you know, Britain's high streets have been struggling for some time, but the South Asian sort of wedding stores and garment stores had been quite resilient because, you know, their ecosystem was completely different. But today, and this piece came out today on the 27th of April, talking about how the South Asian high street is facing a fight for its future in Britain for two reasons, because people are scaling back wedding celebrations because of, you know, changing preferences of young people, and also the cost of living crisis. And so these stores that have been around for, you know, decades, 30 years or so, are now finding not only competition from online stores where people can kind of get cheaper garments and so on, and there's like a lot more choice, but also people are getting married later. You know, they're having smaller weddings. They want the and. You know, I suspect actually there's probably a little bit more kind of interracial marriage as well. And so you might have less of the kind of both huge families kind of trying to demonstrate to their community, you know, the status. I mean, that's a lot of what weddings are. So it's interesting to see whether or not, you know, this is a trend that will sort of plateau or whether this is kind of the end of something that, you know, South Hall, Whitechapel, lots of places, even like this is not just London, it's at Birmingham, it's places all over the country that are really, really struggling with this.
South Hall's a wonderful place to visit, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's gorgeous. And also it's like it's its own, it kind of, you know, I have a friend who's a teacher at one of the schools there. You know, it's a school with like a third Sikh, a third Hindu, a third Muslim. You know, it's like a society that for me is the best of a place like London, because you can kind of exist in this whole world. And of course, places have their problems, but it's beautiful in a way. You can kind of go there and experience completely different things without having to leave, you know, to go outside the M25, as they say.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I feel like I should introduce Guy properly, because I haven't really told you about his myriad achievements. He's a novelist, a playwright, a documentary filmmaker. Also won the Dylan Thomas Prize, the Jalak Prize, the Authors Club Best First Novel Award. That's for the debut novel, Our Mad and Furious City. And was longlisted for the Booker, the Goldsmiths Prize, the Orwell Prize for Political. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Mr., another great book being adapted for the stage now. Called something else.
The Life and Times of Yahya Abbas.
So that, I mean, I don't know if you've read that, but it's a fantastic book.
No, I mean, I will
book.
Definitely now.
But the reason we're talking to you today, and in fact, the two of you are both kind of connected in this way, is about, you've won the Jalak Prize. Have you won the Jalak Prize?
I have not, but I'll have a word with Nabil.
I'll have a word with them. Yeah.
So let's talk about the Jalak Foundation and this new publication that's coming out The Review, and... It's also in conjunction with Writers' Mosaic, I think.
Yeah.
So, Guy, what is The Review?
So The Review is a brand new biannual publication that will exist at the beginning as an insert within The Bookseller, which is the UK's biggest trade publication. It's a publication that's around 20 pages long so far, where we have... it's sort of produced and reviewed by writers of colour in the UK. It covers all sections, so poetry, non-fiction, fiction, as well as children's fiction and YA. So we have this opportunity to have a space within really the heart of the industry, where we get to essentially have conversations about writing alongside each other in this moment. I mean, it felt like a perfect opportunity. It actually was a seed that came out of our friend Sunny Singh, who had a conversation with Philip Jones at the Bookseller about just having a page in the Bookseller. But Philip was actually really generous in saying, well, how about perhaps an 18-page insert? And it sort of developed from there. Sunny called me in to edit it. And my job is essentially just to bring together what we call our curators. So we have a curator for each section, and then they go out and look for established writers, but also brand new writers to review and have a sort of in-depth, intimate read of new books coming out over the next couple of years, next year or so. So we also have a section called Notable, headed up by Sarah Shafi, who looks ahead at books that are coming out also. It's sort of tremendously exciting. We launched it on Thursday with the Bookseller. And I don't know, the feeling of love and also just ambition in the room was palpable. I'm incredibly proud of it.
Because it is just going to grow and grow.
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, it's fairly slim right now, but the idea is to develop into different disciplines. And the idea is to really have these writers and these books speak to each other. Even the way it's put together with our incredible sort of design genius at House of Thought, Michael Salu, who really thought about this idea of mingling our conversations together. So we have the poetry sit alongside the nonfiction and the fiction. And across the whole thing, my job is to look at it as a whole and say, look, here are the ideas and the thoughts and the concerns, the obsessions almost among these writers that are writing currently, and see sort of a trickle a ripple of feeling. The idea is that you read it and you kind of get a little glimpse of what people are thinking and feeling and writing about right now.
Mm. I think something that this reminds me of, I was recently at the Harlem Renaissance exhibition at the Met, and one of the beautiful things about that was there were all of these magazines and pamphlets from the time that really reflect the kind of what writers and artists were thinking about. And I remember looking at all of these, like, quite wonderful historical artifacts and thinking, what is that for us right now? Yeah. And I think the review is definitely that. It's so exciting.
No, that's the aspiration. I mean, I'm sure you'd agree. Like the private conversations I've been having among my friends, writers of color, where they're just so intense and beautiful. And I don't think it can be denied that this is a really interesting moment from writers like my good friend Raymond Antrobus, Victoria Luque-Bulley, Banu Kapil, Yomi Sorda. Like, so many writers are coming up right now who almost write to a different measure altogether. And what I feel about that, which I speak to in my editor's note on the first page of the review, where I talk about this isn't, you know, publications like this are often positioned as sort of responses or posts to some sort of material imbalance, which, it being in a bookseller and that being in itself a progressive step, it's hard to disagree. But actually, the most interesting thing for me is it's almost an act of self-assertion. It's like, we've been here, and so we've been writing. And look at the conversations we've been having in private. And this is a way to step out, honestly, and just say, look, let's invite everyone to read alongside us and write alongside us.
And how can people read this if they don't have a subscription to the bookseller?
Well, it was in every single copy of the bookseller that came out Friday. And it will also, there's a handful of copies that will go to bookshops around the UK. But also, if you want one, DM us. Like, we're either Writers Mosaic or the Jalak Foundation on Twitter or find their site. They will send you a copy. If you're a bookshop, if you're a place that would like to stock the review, please do.
Absolutely. And I should just point out that there are a number of people reviewed in here that, if you're interested in their work, you can hear them on Meet the Writers, including Guy.
Yeah.
Catherine Joy White, for instance. We've got a lovely, lovely interview with her and various other people who are featured here. So wonderful, wonderful initiative, Guy. I think it's just how great to introduce us to some people, worlds that they didn't know existed.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that is the biannual journal, The Review. It's edited by Guy Gunaratne. And this is Monocle on Saturday. You're still with us, Yasmin. And Guy, I hope you'll stay as well. We're just going to have a quick look at casinos, because you nearly got scammed.
Yeah,
didn't
this
you,
is
this
embarrassing.
Week?
This is I wasn't planning to talk about it, but here we are. It's a learning moment for us all. So I'm somebody who really cares a lot about what I would call operational security. You know, I'm big on the, like, 2FA, like, two-factor authentication. I like to use Signal and messaging app, all these sorts of things. I like to think of myself as impenetrable. And yet, the other day I get a phone call and the person was like, oh, we've seen that your card, you know, this number has been used in this location. We think somebody's trying to scam you. And I was like, yes, somebody is trying to scam me, not realizing I was halfway through a scam myself. And the reason why this is really interesting is because I'm sure many listeners have been trapped by or attempted or received an attempt at a scam recently, because scamming, online scams, phone scams, message scams, etc., have rocketed. The number of scam calls and so on have skyrocketed recently. And that's because it's turned into this entire industry. And listeners might have seen a John Oliver deep dive on this recently. The title for this kind of type of scam is called pig butchering, which is very strange. But the reason it came across my radar is because the casinos in Macau have kind of shifted, or the big dirty money actually has shifted from casinos in Macau to these kind of scam industries. And there was this piece in the South China Post, the South China Morning Post, talking about how this dirty money is passing through not only Southeast Asia's online gambling world, but also these scam centers, as they are replacing the choice for financial criminals around the world. And I just think this is fascinating because, you know, there has been this attempt to clean up the casinos in Macau. And so the money looked for a new place to go. Mm. And so these scam centers are a part of it. And I mean, Guy, have you been called by any of these people?
You know, never. Called. I quickly put the phone down, though. But it's strange. You hear these stories, and it's quite another thing to have someone relate their own story, and it's kind of terrifying. Also embarrassing, can't lie.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not proud, okay? But, I mean, the numbers are fast. So, like, for example, the casino industry in Southeast Asia has experienced, this article saying, exponential growth. So you've got over 340 licensed and unlicensed casinos in 2022. I'm just reading here, Macau's junket tycoons, the UN reports as two of the world's largest junket operators, which is an auspicious title. But I just think it's fascinating that they're moving their bases of operation to places like Cambodia, Laos, the Philippines, even Myanmar. And Myanmar is not an easy place to operate, right? So how this is going to sort of play out and what the impact is going to be. I mean, the one note I would also say that is kind of sad is a lot of the people who are actually calling, they themselves have been trafficked. So it's kind of like a double whammy, because not only are the victims the people maybe being scammed, but also the people who are doing the calling, they themselves are trafficked and so on and forced to make these calls. So it's definitely changing the landscape of financial crime.
Absolutely. Now, I'd like to bring Isabella Orlando into this conversation. She is a documentary filmmaker and a communications specialist and has a couple of culture stories she'd like to share with us. Isabella, welcome to the show. Tell us about Yoko Ono at Tate Modern.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. Thanks for having me. I saw the show about 2 weeks ago and it was fantastic. So it's a pretty big show. It includes a lot of kind of Ono's most iconic works, from kind of early paintings, I guess, paintings in quotations, through to kind of later performative, participatory conceptual art. But the kind of red thread, if you will, that seems to run through the whole exhibition is that it foregrounds ideas over objects. So it's about the concept. It's about the kind of seed of the idea that she creates that then becomes an instruction for the viewer to kind of run with. And I just thought that was so refreshing. I left feeling like my brain had like had a workout.
I'm seeing a lot of people saying, oh, we misjudged Yoko Ono.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that's true. I mean, I didn't really realize the context of her work. Like, I had come across some of her instruction pieces before, which for anybody listening that isn't really familiar with them, they're what they sound like. They are an instruction for the viewer to kind of imagine a painting or imagine a kind of piece of conceptual art for themselves. So for example, Painting to See the Room says, drill a small, almost invisible hole in the center of a canvas and see the room through it. But then they often include caveats like the canvas is actually a piece of furniture or a piece of clothing, or it doesn't have to be a canvas at all. And, you know, you have it's felt to me kind of like, actually in the world of generative AI, it felt like a prompt for my imagination in a way. Like it really amazed me that the sort of gamified idea of plugging kind of creative prompts into an algorithm, that you can actually do that with your brain. And she's been kind of doing that all along. And I just really left with that feeling very kind of top of mind.
And that's at the Tate Modern. I want you to tell us now about this radical artivist collective called Looty.
Yes. So they've been operating, I think, since 2020, or at least that was when the idea was conceived. But the story I have here is about the quote unquote repatriation of the Rosetta Stone, which began sort of last March, when the pair, who are, it's a duo, kind of two activists in the art world, Chidi Nwabani and Ahmed Abakar, who are using tech to redistribute kind of the world's contested artifacts, but they're based in London. So a few of these projects have happened at the British Museum. And what's happening is, outside the regulations of kind of technology in museums, like the museum perfectly allows 3D models to be made of artifacts. So it's perfectly legal what they're doing, but they've gone in with an iPad and taken a 3D scan of the Rosetta Stone and of the Benin bronzes. And they are using these 3D scans, turning them into NFTs and kind of repatriating the artifacts that way, through digital copies that are not owned by the institution that holds the real thing.
It sounds absolutely extraordinary. Do you think a digital reproduction is enough, or do communities in the world deserve the real thing? And how is that achievable?
Yeah, it's such a good question. So I made a documentary about the repatriation debate in 2020. Well, it was finished in 2020. So over the kind of few years before that, I was researching and having these conversations. And something that became so clear to me through that project was how much power and charge the real thing has. Because I think when we talked about technology and digital copies as a potential, I guess, solution, as part of the solution to the problem, people seem to think that, you know, the real thing was actually really important, and having the real artifact in the home country, in the home community, was a big part of the call. It was the literal thing that held so much power and symbolism for people. But I actually think now that it's the act of the return that's actually important. And so it's this idea that I think even if it's a digital copy, if someone representing a community goes in and kind of reclaims what feels like it's been stolen, it can be kind of healing and kind of satisfying in a different way, even if the real thing is not moving at all.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Guy, do you think, though, that yes, you can have the digital representation of it, but what about the apology? Isn't that really important?
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I'm agreed. I don't know. I always wonder about this. I always think about it from a writer's perspective and an artist's perspective, I guess. It's navigating through uncertain times is always interesting, but also perhaps generative. I don't know. I do feel like being disturbed in any way is something that could lead to something further. And inspiration is the wrong word, but I suppose it's generative in some way.
Yes, me?
Do you know, this is an odd response, but sometimes I wonder, what would be in the British Museum if they repatriated everything?
Yeah.
You know, like, what would they choose to represent Britain? And I think that is maybe a provocation that I would give the museum. You know, like, you, like, okay, we get it. You have lots of, but in a moment in time where Britain, I think, is really grappling with its sense of self, which in its kind of trying and not trying to deal with its colonial past, what does it look like to think of, like, is it possible to conceive of Britain without its relationship to coloniality? I don't know. And I think that's a really interesting question.
Well, it's the relationship, though, that's the most interesting. I want to sort of dive into that bit, what's between ourselves, our histories, and each other today.
Yeah, also, like, if I just extend this slightly, I think often the conversation is about what it did to the place that was colonized,
right,
rather than what it did to Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a conversation, like, you know, the sort of the trauma and the violence also affects the perpetrator. So what did it do to you? That is a question
exactly.
I would love them to reflect on.
Yeah, yeah.
This is definitely a discussion that we need to pursue. Sadly, we're out of time. Thank you all very much. Isabella Orlando, thank you for coming on. Thanks to Guy Gunaratne. And I can tell you that also the review, which is out now, it's part of the bookseller, but you can get it online at Writers Mosaic, apparently. Yasmin, always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
To have two good friends in the studio
with
you this morning.
Thank you so much.
And many thanks to our producer and studio engineer, Mariella Bevan. Monocle on Saturday returns at the same time next weekend. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.